Okay, good evening, everybody. Thank you for all coming. Tonight's shiur is sponsored by Mr. Leo Kyle. Lezecha Nishmas, his father. His father's yahrzeit is coming up. Reb Aaron Halevi Kyle. The neshama should have an aliyah. Thank you very much for your sponsorship. The topic of tonight's discussion is kinyan kesef. Kinyan kesef means that you can acquire something through money. It's always important just to clarify that when you want to purchase a piece of land, so obviously you have to pay for it. That goes without saying. But you also have to perform an act of acquisition. You have to acquire it. So you can acquire the piece of land in a number of ways. So that there are always two issues. There's the issue of paying for the land, and there's the issue of acquiring the land. So when we talk about kinyan kesef, we talk about using the money as the very act of acquisition. That would mean that once I pay you a little bit for the land, that the land is mine. The land is mine, and now I owe you the balance. But the land is mine, as opposed to saying that I don't even own the land yet. Or, alternatively, I can acquire the land with a different method of acquisition, and then I can just owe you the entire sum. So when we talk about acquiring a piece of land, we're not discussing paying for the land, we're discussing acquiring it. So tonight's topic is kinyan kesef. That means the method of acquiring through payment, which would mean that I'm actually acquiring. And then we're also going to talk about shtaris, which I guess a shtar, I guess a good translation would be a promissory note, that somebody owes me money, so I have a shtar, I have a document, I have a promissory note that enables me to collect the loan. So that also has value. A promissory note itself has value. And then we're going to be speaking about today's a check, what the concept of a check is, how they analyze what actually is a check. Is a check considered cash? Is a check considered a promissory note? What exactly is the intrinsic value of a check? Okay, so let's first look at some of the Gemaras that as a way of background to this topic. So the Gemara says in Bava Metzia on Mem Zayin Amud Beis, this is a basic argument between Rabbi Yochanan and Reish Lakish. So Rabbi Yochanan says, Dvar Torah Ma'os Koinos. So Dvar Torah Ma'os Koinos. So by the way, so someone just mentioned that a deed is a shtar. So when I talk about a shtar, there are two types of documents. One document is the deed, which I might use to transfer ownership of the land. But this, I'm not going to be discussing that tonight. I'm going to be discussing a shtar chov. A shtar chov is a promissory note, which means that I have proof that somebody owes me money because I have a shtar chov. Okay, let's get to the topic here. The Gemara says in Bava Metzia, Omer Rabbi Yochanan, Dvar Torah Ma'os Koinos. So this is very interesting. Rabbi Yochanan is of the opinion that midoraisa, from the Torah's point of view, when I want to acquire metaltlin, I want to acquire movable objects. So I would like to purchase from you a sefer. I would like to purchase from you a piece of furniture. I want to purchase from you an automobile, a car. So whenever you're purchasing movable items, metaltlin, movable items, so Rabbi Yochanan says that the proper method of acquisition is mos. I pay. I can either pay in full, or I can pay a partial payment, and now I will have acquired your automobile, and now I owe you the balance. Mos comes. So the Gemara says, though, that nowadays the rabbis intervened. The rabbi said that although that's the kinyan midoraisa, that's the biblical kinyan, but nevertheless, so why did the Chachamim say that if I pay for the object, imagine if I want to purchase a piece of furniture. So I give you the money, so technically I own the furniture, but the rabbi stepped in and said, not so fast, I don't yet own the furniture. Although, midoraisa, I do, but the rabbis came in and they, to a certain extent, nullified the kinyan, and they said, I only finalize the sale if I perform meshicha. Meshicha means that I actually draw the object close, I have to take the object out of your domain and I have to bring it into my domain. So I don't acquire the object until I actually took possession physically of the object and brought it into my domain. Why did the Chachamim do that? Why didn't the Chachamim leave it as is, that I've acquired the piece of furniture with the payment? Because that's midoraisa, the proper way to acquire. So the Gemara has a very interesting concern. Because we're afraid, if I would pay the merchant for the furniture, so imagine if I gave him his money, I want to buy a dishwasher, I want to buy an oven. So I give the money to the merchant, the item, the appliance, or the piece of furniture, whatever it is still in the warehouse of the merchant. What happens if there's a fire? What happens if there's something beyond anybody's control and the object gets lost? So in the meantime, it's my problem because I paid you for the object. The object is mine, fair and square. And now my object is sitting in your domain. If anything would happen to the object, then it would be my loss. And you have no responsibility to protect the object. Maybe you're a shomer chinah. But this way of commerce where you can create a situation where I own the object and the object has not yet been delivered could create a problem for the market. If we would nullify the sale and we would treat the object as if it's still in the possession of the merchant, so he's going to exert the effort to save the object. Torahu matzil, he'll try to save it. And if not, lo mosar nafshe, Torah hamatzel. He's not going to bother to save it. So the Chachamim, they determined that in today's day and age, if I'm going to pay for an object and the object will be mine, although it's still in the possession of the merchant, we're afraid that something could happen to the object and the merchant feels no obligation to try to exert effort to save the object because it's not his anymore. He got his money. What does he care? He's under no obligation to protect the object, and people are going to stop. It's going to interfere with the normal practice. So because of that, says Rabbi Yochanan, although ma'us is konos, although midoraisa, money is the true kinyan, nevertheless, the rabbis instituted that we have to have meshicha. It's not considered mine until I draw the object into my own domain, because we can't have it that the object is sitting in the merchant's domain, because if it gets lost or something happens to it, then the consumer will lose out. He will have already paid, and he won't be able to be refunded. That is Rabbi Yochanan's opinion. Reish Lakish is of the opinion, no. Meshicha mefereshes min haTorah. Reish Lakish holds that the true kinyan is meshicha. You have to draw the object close. That's the true kinyan. So Rabbi Yochanan says the true kinyan is the payment, but the rabbi said you have to have meshicha. Reish Lakish says no. On the contrary, the true kinyan is actually the meshicha. My time at the Reish Lakish. Why does Reish Lakish say what he says? Omar Kro, because the pasuk says, because the pasuk says that you're selling something to your friend, you're purchasing something from your friend. So the Gemara makes a drasha from the words, you're purchasing something from your friend. Davar hanikne miyad liyad. The pasuk implies that we're discussing movable objects, things that you can transfer from one domain to the other. So Reish Lakish sees in the verse that the kinyan is the taking of the object into your own domain. Most Rishonim paskin like Rabbi Yochanan, but Rashi's opinion is to paskin like Reish Lakish. If you recall, not too long ago, a few weeks ago, when we were discussing Hefker, Bez, and Hefker, we touched on that when we purchase a lulav, if we purchase a lulav and the Torah requires that the lulav belong to me, in order for me to fulfill my obligation, I have to own the lulav. So the poskim are concerned that you have to own the lulav on a biblical level. It's not enough to only own it rabbinically. We discussed if the Rabbanan's act of hefker will actually make it mine or not. But the poskim are concerned that I should perform a biblical kinyan. So that's why the Magen Avraham says that I have to pay for the lulav and I have to take the lulav into my possession, because we want to make sure that the lulav truly belongs to me. According to Rabbi Yochanan, the kinyan midoraisa is to pay for the lulav. So says the Magen Avraham, although you're going to obviously pick up your lulav and esrog, you're going to take it home, you're going to have it in your domain, so you perform mishicha, but you didn't pay for it yet. According to Rabbi Yochanan, it might not be completely yours, because the true kinyan is the money, is the payment. So says the Magen Avraham, you have to make sure to acquire the lulav and the esrog on every level, so you have to perform mishicha in order to accommodate Reish Lakish, and you have to perform kesef in order to accommodate Rabbi Yochanan. So it's really important to know what the true kinyan is. Another area of halacha where it would be relevant is because nowadays we don't want to have a bechor, we don't want to have kachim walking around, we don't have a Beis HaMikdash. So imagine if I would have a sacrificial animal walking around. You're not allowed to benefit from the animal. We obviously can't offer it as a sacrifice. So imagine if I have a cow, and the cow is going to give birth to the first abachar, a first-time baby boy, and I'll have a calf, a boy calf, a male calf. So that will be a bachar. What am I going to do with it? I can't work with it. I can't milk it. I can't shear it if it's a sheep. So what am I going to do with this firstborn? So what we try to do is we try to transfer ownership of the mother cow to a non-Jew. The Gemara tells us that if a non-Jew owns the cow, similar to Mechiras Chametz, if a non-Jew owns the cow, then that will exempt the cow from the halacha of Bechor, Petarechem. So we have to now determine what the proper kinyan is to transfer ownership of the cow to the non-Jew. Is the kinyan the Meshicha, drawing the cow close into his domain? Is the kinyan kesef? It's important to know. It also comes up selling the chametz. When we want to sell the chametz to a non-Jew, we have to make sure that we employ the proper method of acquisition of transferring ownership. So it's really important to know what exactly is the biblical method to transfer ownership. Is it the kesef, or is it the meshicha, or is it something else? That's one point. Now there's another Gemara, Kedushin on Daf Chavav Amud Aleph. The Gemara tells us, Nechasim Sheish Lehem Achrayis, when you have real estate, land that has Achrayis, land that can be accounted for, property that can be accounted for, that means land, real estate. Like in English, it's referred to as real estate. It's real, it can't be lost, it's something attached to the ground. Nechasim Sheish Lehem Achrayis, Nechasim that has a guarantee to it, because it's real estate. So in that case, everybody agrees that it can be acquired with kesef, with money, or with shtar. Shtar would be a deed that the moicher, the owner of the land, would give me a title saying that he's transferring the ownership of the land or the real estate, the house, the home, to me. Or chazaka, or I can perform an act that shows ownership on the piece of property, on the real estate. So the halacha is that land is certainly transferred through money, because you don't have the gzeira. Once I purchase the land, then the land is already in my possession. You don't have the gzeira that something might happen to the land after I already paid for it. So in that case, the chachamim left the kinyan as it is, and the land belongs to me after payment. When it comes to movable items, the rabbis intervened and they mitigated the kinyan, and it's not fully mine until I take the property into my domain. But when it comes to land, the kinyan kesef certainly works. The Gemara says an interesting thing. The Mishnah in Kedushin says, Nechasim she'ein lahem achrayis, nikdin in nechasim she'esh lahem achrayis. There's a special kinyan referred to as kinyan agav. Agav means like agav urcha, like by the way. Once you're acquiring the land with a proper kinyan, if you're ever buying movable items along with that, then it'll be acquired automatically agav the karka. So imagine if you're purchasing a home and there's some furniture in the home, or there's some backyard furniture in the backyard, and you're purchasing the home from somebody else, and the moicher, the seller of the property, is leaving over some movable items there. There might be some photographs or pictures or chandeliers attached to the ceiling, or some furniture in the house, or other items of value that he wants to sell along with the house. So then we paskin that if you pay for the house, you can acquire the movable items along with the piece of real estate. So although you can't acquire metalkalin with kesef anymore, because the rabbis made exera lest the object gets lost, we want the object to be in your rishus. But if you're acquiring a piece of property, the merchandise will go along with the piece of property, even if the merchandise is not sitting on the actual piece of property. So you can actually transfer ownership of movable items, even if the item is somewhere in Eretz Yisrael, and you're selling me a piece of real estate over here, I can acquire the movable property by agav, through it's like it's sort of subordinate to the real estate transaction, and I'll be able to acquire it. Okay, so that's some background that there's such a thing called kinyan kesef. Nowadays, it doesn't work for metalpolin, but it works for real estate. There's a fascinating few halachas that the Mishnah in Masechet Shavuos enumerates that actually categorizes for us different types of commodities, different types of ownership. It's a fascinating concept here in the Mishnah in Shavuos. The Mishnah tells us, Elu dvarim she'ein hishboin aleihem. So there are certain objects that you're automatically exempt from taking an oath. So we know that if we ever get into a dispute, so I claim that you owe me $100, you admit to owning part of that, you admit that you owe 50, but the other 50 you deny. So we know the Torah tells us that there's a shvua that the defendant has to swear that he doesn't owe the other half. Another example, if I have an eid echad, if I have a witness that says you owe me something, you have to swear. The eid echad, the one witness, triggers an oath. If I say you owe me $100 and you deny the entire claim, so you would not need to swear midoy raisa because you did not admit to any partial admission, any partial debt. If I can produce a witness that says you owe me the money, you'll have to swear regarding the entire claim. So there's such a thing. There are certain circumstances where the Torah imposes an oath on the defendant. However, the Mishnah tells us that there are certain items that we might be disputing that are automatically exempt from oaths. So here's a list of things. Avadim, in the old days, if you have an Eved Knaini, if you have a servant, a slave. Shtaris, if you have promissory notes. Shtaris. So that means that I'm holding debts of other people. Other people owe me money, and I have a whole satchel filled of shtaris that people owe me money. Maybe you owe me $100, he owes me $1,000, he owes me $10,000, and I have a whole bundle of promissory notes that have value. Imagine if I would deposit these promissory notes with a shomer, and then there would be a dispute, and I would want to impose an oath on the shomer. The halacha is that shtaris are automatically exempt from oath. The defendant will never have to swear regarding a dispute over a shtar. If I deposited two documents with you, I have two promissory notes on Reuven and Shimon, and I'm going away. I wanted to deposit my shtaris with you, and then I ask you, upon return, I ask you, where are my shtaris? You give me one. Where's the other one? So you say you only gave me one. So that would normally be moed b'miksas. Normally you admitted partially. You should have to swear regarding the other object. But shtaris are automatically exempt from this rule. And the same thing applies to real estate. Real estate is exempt from this rule. It seems like these items are not fully ownable items. In other words, the land is something that you really can't say belongs to me. If I have an item, I can consume the item, I can destroy the item. A piece of land is a different type of commodity which does not have the same kind of ownership over that piece of property that you would have over a movable item. And the same thing applies to a document. A document is an interesting kind of a commodity. The Gemara says again, Tashlumei Kefel. We know the rule that if I would steal something from you and I'm caught, I would have to return the item, the principal, plus I have to pay double. It's a penalty, kefel. We know that a ganav pays kefel. If I would steal a promissory note that you have, imagine if you have a promissory note saying that Reuven owes you $100, and I would steal that promissory note, and I would claim that you gave me that promissory note, and then I'm caught that I stole it, the Adam testified that I stole it, I would have to obviously return the note, but I do not have to pay double the value of the note. We would not go assess the value of that promissory note, the market value, and I would have to pay you double. Shtaris are exempt from kefel. And the same thing applies to shomer chinam, like we just said, so shomer sachar, that different types of shomerim, different types of custodians that have various degrees of liability. If I would deposit a shtar with a shomer, and he was either negligent, or if he's a paid watchman where he would normally be liable if the item is stolen or lost, he's exempt. If the person for somehow borrowed the document or something of that nature, and an einus happens to it, he's exempt. So there are some peculiar halachas that shtaris are exempt from shvua. There are no oaths when it comes to a dispute over documents. There is no kefel. If the document is stolen, the thief would not have to pay double. Obviously, he has to give back what's yours. There would be no penalty to give back what double. And the same thing applies of a shomer, that the shomer would not have a responsibility to pay for the document. He can offer to watch the document, obviously. You can pay him to watch the document. But if the document ends up getting stolen, normally the shomer sakar will be obligated to pay. He's exempt when it comes to shtaris. A fascinating halacha. So the Gemara says, the Gemara gives the source from the Torah for these halachas. So we'll just do one example. It's interesting how it works. If you look at item Gimel, so the Gemara quotes a pasuk. The Tanu Rabbanan, so in item Gimel, it's like the fourth line. Al kol dvar pesha. The pasuk talks about the obligation to pay double. Anything that you were negligent about. So the Gemara says klal. That's a general statement. The pasuk says al kol dvar pesha. We're discussing any object that the custodian might have been negligent about. Klal, that's a general statement. The pasuk continues now to give certain examples. Shor, chamor, seh, salma. The Gemara says, the pasuk says, an ox, a donkey, a sheep, or a garment, prat. Those are individual examples. So what happened here was, the Gemara is analyzing the construct of the pasuk. The pasuk says a klal, a general statement. Then the pasuk details some examples of the statement. Al kol aveda, anything that was lost, chozar v'klal. The pasuk gives us again a general statement. So this is a famous formula in the Gemara. Klal uprat uklal. Whenever the pasuk is structured, that there's a general statement, then a specifics, and then another general statement that sums it up at the end. So the way we take that pasuk, we say the pasuk is giving us examples. You would be liable, or those examples are subject to whatever the halacha is. Only things that are similar to those examples. So what were the examples in the pasuk? We have an ox, we have a donkey, we have a sheep, we have a garment. These are regular, normal, movable objects that were common back in those days. So we say, here is the criteria for when these halachas apply. Iyatadon elekein haprat. We'll apply this halacha to anything similar to the examples. Maha prat mefurish davar metalkel. So condition number one, it has to be a movable item, because every example that the Torah gave for these halachas are movable items. An ox, a donkey, a sheep, a garment. All of these things are things that can be moved around. They're not real estate. Another criteria, another condition, it has to be gufoy mamin. It has to have intrinsic value. These objects that are listed in the pasuk all have value in and of themselves. The ox has value. You can work with the ox. You can shech the ox. You can eat the ox. You can milk the cow. These things have intrinsic value. The sheep, the donkey, you can work with the donkey, the garment. These items have intrinsic value. They're gufay mamon. So says the Gemara, the only time these halachas apply is if it's a movable object, excluding land, real estate. It has to be gufay mamon. It has to have intrinsic value. This excludes land, because land is not a movable object. This excludes slaves, because slaves are always compared to land. Slaves had the status of real estate, because it's a kind of an ownership. It's a commodity that's not an ordinary commodity. And then shtaris. And I emboldened it because that's the topic. Even though the shtaris are movable, so they're not exempt based on they're not real estate, but they have a category of their own. They're not gufay mamon. They don't have intrinsic value. Rashi explains, what does it mean that a shtar doesn't have intrinsic value? We're discussing a promissory note. I could have a note that says that Ploni, Ruvain, owes me $1 million, $1 billion. Anybody would love to have such a note. It seems to me that note is like the most valuable thing in the world. Everybody would want to get their hands on such a note. But the Gemara tells us that a shtar is ein gufay mamon. It doesn't have intrinsic value. Rashi explains, Ein gufay mamon, it doesn't have intrinsic value. The ein lahem erech atzmi, they don't have any intrinsic value. Ein oimdim el l'rayu, they only serve as proof to something else. The entire value of the shtar is only proof to something else. It's proof that I'm owed money. So that's the value. So a shtar doesn't have intrinsic value. It's proof that you owe me money. So people are asking about stocks. So stocks represent like an ownership in a property. You probably would be able to explain better than I what a stock is, or someone else raised the issue of a bond. A bond is a debt. It's probably a promissory note because you've invested money in the government. The government issues you a bond. You now are owed money, and the bond is proof that you're owed money. A stock might be a little different. A stock represents proof that you own a piece of a company. So that might be, it's not that you're owed money, it's proof that that you own something. So the shtar itself, the actual piece of paper doesn't have intrinsic value. The entire value of the document is proof to something else. So although $1 billion shtar, if I have a document that says you owe me $1 billion, has tremendous value. You know, I would be able to sell that on the market for almost $1 billion because people would be willing to give me $900 million to have a shtar that enables them to collect $1 billion. So I can certainly raise cash with this document, but it's only because people are willing to pay for the proof that the cash, the value is really somewhere else. This is just proof to that. So a shtar is not gufay mamon. That's why it's exempt from all of these rules, because when you're dealing with a shtar, you're not really dealing with the actual value. It's only like a handle on the value. It's only a proof to the value. Now, we see from here that the Gemara in item Dalid, we see from here that the Gemara is defining and creating two categories. There's mamon, there's the actual currency, which has value. Imagine in the old days, a person has a sack of gold coins. He has a sack of gold coins, which is $1 million worth of gold. That has intrinsic value. And then you also have a shtar. A shtar might even be more valuable technically than the pile of gold coins. The shtar might represent a debt of $1 billion. But the shtar itself only represents a debt. It's proof to collect the debt, but it's not the actual money. It's only proof. It's a step removed. It doesn't have intrinsic value. So we make these two categories. Now, the Achronim, and there's a big Chassam Sofer that I would like to share with you, the Achronim, they discussed today's money. Now, when the Chassam Sofer was discussing this, he was probably discussing like the middle level where the government would issue currency, paper money, and the paper money would actually be a promissory note on the Gizbor, on the Oitzer of the Melech, that the government, the Prussian government, or back then, there was an Oitzer, there was a mint, that they had all of the silver coins or the bullion or the gold in a vault somewhere. And technically you could go and you can actually redeem a piece of gold with the promissory note. So the shtar, the currency was backed by real value. The question is, that currency might only be like a shtar. It doesn't have intrinsic value because it only represents value. So imagine if I would deposit with you a stack of $100 bills, you would lose the money. So are you exempt? Because the Torah says that a shomer is exempt over shtaris. So today's cash, is it considered not having intrinsic value? Today's cash is even less because today's cash is not even backed up by any real value. It's basically a hesked. It's basically a consensus. It's basically an agreement within the country to treat this with value. It basically represents the United States government. It's backed by the United States government, whatever that means exactly. So people attribute value to today's currency because it's backed by the government. And there's a hesked. There's basically an agreement by the world to treat this as currency. So how do we treat this today in halacha? Is it considered to be intrinsic value, or is it only an agreement because it represents some kind of value somewhere else because the government would back it, whatever that means practically, whatever that would mean. So there's an interesting Chassam Sofer. The Chassam Sofer says, imagine what this would mean if our currency was considered a shtar. I can go into your house, I can steal $1,000, and if I could steal, $1,000 and not have to pay double, because we're arguing that the currency doesn't have intrinsic value. So the Chassam Sofer says exactly that. The Chassam Sofer says, and it's beautiful how he writes here, the Chassam Sofer is the Shailas and Tshuva Chassam Sofer in Yerideya, Kuf Lamed Dalet, so it's response 134. He talks about currency. He says like this, let's read it together. Avo Geder Matbea. What is the Geder? How do we define a coin? How do we define a minted coin? Shegozar HaMelech Olav Shetetze. A coin, currency, is that the king, the government, decreed that it should be legal tender. Now, Mishim Mayan Milimkor, imagine if a vendor would refuse to sell something because he doesn't like the way your money looks. So the Chassam Sofer has a very strong expression. He says the king would have your head. Imagine if you would get up and say, I'm selling, I want to sell something. I don't like the way your $100 bill looks. I want a newer, I want the new, I'm a coin collector. I want the new print of the dollar bill. I don't want the old print. You can't do that as long as the currency is legal tender. So it's illegal to not to accept the money. And now the Chassam Sofer says something interesting. He says, Dina de Mahusa din emes, when the king decrees that certain trinkets should be used as a currency, or the printed money we have today should be used as a currency, that's a din emes. That's a true din. And it's a mishpat tzedek. And then he brings the Gemara in Pesachim, those that are learning Daf Yomi, that we had it not too long ago. It's not only is it Malchus da'ara l'chud gozer olav, not only did the earthly king decree that this should, that it's illegal to refuse this money, that we have to use this money as currency, el gam Malchus d'rakia, Hashem himself decreed this, kimavur perek makom shenoagu im psachim nundalad on the base. In Meseches Pesachim 54b, the Gemara tells us that currency, the concept of currency, that people are willing to sell real intrinsic things for just mere currency, is really something that's like beyond our comprehension. It's a gzeira. Hashem was the one who put this concept into our minds, that we're willing to accept currency in place, in return for real objects, things that we really have a use for, food, homes, movable objects, cows, donkeys, nowadays cars, whatever we need, we're paid with currency. I'm willing to put in a day's work and be paid with a piece of paper. This is really something that Hashem put into our minds, that we should be willing, that the world should operate this way. It's a decree from Hashem. So says the Chassam Sofer, when a government decrees that this is legal tender, this is currency, so really the government itself is backed by Hashem, because Hashem was the one who created this concept that there should be a concept of a currency. So says the Chassam Sofer, Ein chilek em yezov ay kesef ay nir. So based on this understanding, when we discuss intrinsic value, so it's no longer relevant if the coin is made out of gold or silver, or if it's paper money, because the intrinsic value is not that it itself has a metallic value. It's the what defines currency is the fact that it was decreed by the government that it should be legal tender. Says the Chassam Sofer, Ein loymer bezesh, Ein loymer el l'rayv shavoy. It's not because it's proof that you can get. Because hare kamon, kama pa'amim ha'am misupakim begroin kesef. So back in the day, sometimes...
How are you telling?
Back in the day, so some people were yes, worried that the government would void, that the government would void the cash. So back in the day, the people might have been worried that the government would passel, would void the cash, and therefore people would be reluctant to sell something based on this cash. You hear the stories where back in the day the Russian government, there was a war and the currency became void, so people are reluctant to sell, but it was still illegal to not accept this currency. So it's not because you're relying on the raya, it's because of the gzeira that decrees that this should be considered legal tender. That's how the Chassam Sofer explains it, and that is the determining factor to intrinsic value. The Chassam Sofer gives us a mashal. Imagine if the king would give you a document. Like we know, we hear of all the stories that you can walk into my treasure house and take whatever the king wants to reward someone. You can walk into my treasure house and take whatever your heart desires. So that permission slip would have tremendous value, but that doesn't have intrinsic value because nobody is required to accept that as value. Nobody's required to accept that in return for goods and services, and therefore it's not legal tender. It doesn't have the status of money. That would only have the status, perhaps, of a raya, of something that just proof to something else. The Chazon Ish says the same thing in item Zayin on the next page. The Chazon Ish says the same thing in Chesha Mishpat Tezayin Ois Chavdalet. Our currency has the status of currency for all the dinim of the Torah. The Chazon Ish says you can use paper money to redeem a bechor. You would be able to use paper money to redeem Maaser Sheni. Anything that the Torah requires money for, our paper money, our currency is legal tender. It would qualify for kesef for all the dinei Torah. I wrote here on my own in at the end of item Zion, kimidumali, that I think, this is me talking, I think that the minig nowadays is still to use the silver coins because there are some people that are not as confident as the Chassam Sofer and the Chazon Ish. So the minig, I believe the minig is, I never saw an opinion of them where they use just paper money. We always try to procure the silver that has a certain amount of silver in it, certain amount of grams of silver in it, and I've never seen people use paper money. But the Chazon Ish says that our paper money, our currency, technically would have the full status of money. It's considered having intrinsic value. Okay, so that's as far as our currency is concerned. The Poskim discuss what's the status of a check. So I write a check to you for $100. So now you have a check in your hand that entitles you to go to the bank and retrieve $100 from my bank account. What is the status of a check? So now, what a check does is, obviously, we all know, a check is that you now have a permission to go to the bank and they will withdraw $100 from my account and give you $100 because I issued you a check. So is a check considered money? Is a check considered a promissory note? Or is a check something else? Maybe a check is even less than a promissory note. Let's go through a Gemara in Kedushin, and this Gemara in Kedushin will bring out a lot of different aspects of what we can do with debts and what we can do with a shtar choiv, and we'll see, we'll analyze, and we'll try to apply what we learn in the Gemara to our checks. The Gemara says in Kedushin, a man goes to a woman and says, "Hiskai shli b'shtar choiv." So nowadays we always perform the Kedushin with a ring, a simple ring, that the woman, that the girl shouldn't be fooled into thinking that the ring is worth more than it is. By now already there's a custom how to do it. Imagine if a man would go over to a girl, a woman, and he would say, "Listen, I have a promissory note. Somebody owes me $1 million, and I have a promissory note that I can collect $1 million from Reuven. I'm willing to marry you with this $1 million promissory note. You'll be rich. I'm going to give you a shtar that says that you, I'm going to transfer the debt to you. And by giving you the value of the debt, you'll have the right to collect that debt. So will you marry me based on the fact that I'm giving you a shtar choiv that has value? Because you'll be able to collect $1 million from the other person from moving." So the Gemara says like this, "Hiskai shli b'shtar choiv. Marry me with this shtar choiv. I'm going to transfer this shtar choiv over to you." So imagine like in our day and age, you know how like people, "I have a check from you for $100. I'll just give the check over to somebody else. The check was written to cash. I'll give the check over to somebody else." So you go to the woman and say, "Marry me. I'm going to transfer this shtar choiv over to you properly." Or you have an oral debt. You don't even have a shtar choiv. You don't even have a document that is proof to the debt. You just have an oral debt. Maybe there are witnesses to the debt. So I want to somehow, I go to the woman, I want to somehow, I'm owed $1 million. I don't even have a proof to it. I don't have a shtar. Everybody admits to the debt. The person's not going to deny the debt. I have witnesses to that fact. I want to somehow transfer that debt to you, and I want to marry you in return for the value of this right to collect $1 million. So either I'm going to give you a debt to that effect, or I don't even have the document. I don't even have a shtar. I don't even have the deed or the promissory note. I'm going to just, I have an oral loan. I want to somehow transfer the oral loan to you. You'll be the owner of the loan and you'll be married. You'll give me your hand in marriage in return for that. So there's a machlekes. Rav Meir says, Mikudeshes, it's a good kedusha. This is considered a valid method of kinyan. We talked about kinyan kesef. This can be used as a kinyan kesef. We can use the choiv, the debt, as a commodity, as if it has value and it's a kedusha. The Chachamim say, Einu Mikudeshes, it's not a good kedusha. It's an invalid form of kinyan. So the Gemara now goes through various interpretations what the crux of the issue is. So first the Gemara says, we're talking about a shtar choiv da acher. We're talking about, like we explained, that I have a document, I have a promissory note against someone else, and I want to transfer the promissory note over to you in order to acquire something. By the way, the Gemara is talking about Kedushin, but the same thing would apply purchasing something, purchasing real estate. Can I use, this is Kinyan Kesef that we're talking about. Could I use a Shtar as a Kinyan Kesef? So the Gemara says the case is talking about I have a Shtar Choyv against someone else, and I want to transfer the shtar chayv over to you, and that would be considered giving you money to be able to purchase something, to acquire, to create, to affect the kedushin, or to acquire a house or some other real estate. So says the Gemara, v'hacha b'milva b'shtar or b'milva al peka miflugi. We're discussing two different issues: a case when you have a debt, you have a promissory note, and a case when it's an oral loan. Kamiflagi b'milva b'shtar, but my plagi, what would the argument be whether you can use the shtar as a good kedushin? But plukta the Rebbe for Rabbanan kamiflagi, the argument is based on an argument of Rebbe and the Rabbanan, an argument in Baba Basra, the Sanya. Oisius niknas b'masira, divrei Rebbe. So it's fascinating. Everybody agrees, according to this interpretation, everybody agrees that if I could somehow transfer the debt to you by giving you the document and allowing you to collect the loan, everybody agrees that potentially it should be a good kedushin. It would be considered giving something to the girl of value. The machlekes is a technicality. The machlekes is, how do you transfer the debt over to the girl or to the moicher, to the real estate agent? Whatever it is, whatever transaction we're discussing, what's the proper method of transferring the debt to the second person? Rebbe says you merely have to give over the document. I have a document saying that somebody owes me $1 million. Simply handing the document to you with the intent to transfer the loan will transfer the loan to you, and you are now the legal owner of that debt. You can go collect that debt. So the debtor, the one who owes you the money, is going to say, "Wait a minute, I didn't borrow it from you. I borrowed it from the first guy. I don't want to pay you." So you would be able to say no. Because since your malve, your creditor, he transferred the document over to me with the intent of transferring over the debt, that's a legal form of transferring. That's an acquisition. And now I'm the legal owner of the debt. I'm allowed to collect the debt from you. And just like you would have had to have paid him, you now have to pay me. That's what Rebbe holds. The Chachamim say no. Ben shekosav le'mosar. That's an insufficient way of transferring the choiv. You have to give over the document, plus you have to write another document on that document saying that I hereby, by physically giving you this document, you have to write down in a second document that I'm hereby transferring to you the debt and the shibud, the lien, and all of the privileges that is represented by this document. So Rebbe says it's simply sufficient to physically hand over the debt, the document. The Rabbanan hold, you have to hand over the document. In addition to that, you have to write a second document explaining your intentions that you want to transfer the debt and the shibudim, all the obligations and all of the liens and all of the achrayas over to the second person. So the case in our story was that the man went over to the woman and he gave her this $1 million shtar, but he did not write an additional shtar. So the reason why Rav Meir says it's a good kedushin is because he did enough to transfer the debt. The reason why the Chachamim say it's not a good kedushin is because he did not do enough to transfer the debt. He did not write the second document. But everybody would agree in theory that if I would give over the document and plus I would write the obligatory second document, the requisite second document, then the loan would be transferred. That's the first shot in the Gemara. Then the Gemara says a fascinating thing. The Gemara says, Iba Yisema, if you want, you will say, that they argue regarding the halacha of Shmuel. So Shmuel says the following. Shmuel says, and this is the way most of the Rishonim explain, because a debt is really an intangible thing. You can't really transfer the debt because the debt was owed to me. It's intangible. It's not something that's subject to kinyan. The rabbis created a rabbinical kinyan, and this really ties into what we were discussing the other week with Hefker, Bez, and Hefker. When I give the document over to you, according to Rebbe, or even if I give the document over to you and I write a second document like the Chachamim say, technically the money's still owed to me. It's only a rabbinic transaction that I transfer the debt to you. So believe it or not, I can double-cross you and I can be moichel. If I pardon the loive, he won't have to pay you. Even though you paid me for the document, and even though I transferred the document over to you, and even though I authorized you and I empowered you to collect the debt from the loive, but technically I'm still the malve, and I have the right to be moichel and pardon the loive. Obviously, it would not be the right thing to do, and there's a whole separate discussion if I would be liable to reimburse you the money that you gave me, if I'm liable for damages for doing that. But technically, I have the ability to be moichel the debt. So the machlokes Rav Meir and the Rabbanan is that Rav Meir says the woman agrees to get married. The Chachamim say she doesn't agree to get married because deep down she's afraid that you'll be moichel the debt. It's not really finalized. She's not getting something without any strings attached. It's possible that you could technically be moichel, so she's not soimich das. We talked about this last week with the Davar Shlei Bo Le'olam, that a kinyan has to have smichas das. So since I could be moichel, therefore the woman refuses, even though she's accepting the shtar, but she's insecure, she's not being soimich das, she really deep down is not committed because she's afraid deep down that you can be moichel, you can always double cross her, so she's not willing to give the kedushin. She might be saying she's willing, but that she can't muster enough conviction to actually marry you with this form of kesef. That's the second gemara. This is the machlokes with shtar. So what we've learned here was that you could transfer a debt either by giving over the document or possibly writing a second document on the first document. And then there's another concept here that this whole transaction is only rabbinic, so it leaves room for me to be moichel the loiv. That's one set of interesting ideas that the Gemara says. Let's move on now to the next item, item Yud, Milva Alpeh. Milva Alpeh was the second case that we had in question, the oral loan. So now I can't give over the document. There's no document to give. How do I transfer an oral loan to you where I don't even have the handle of the shtar that I can use to represent giving you the debt because there is no debt? How do I transfer the debt? Somebody owes me $100, $1 million. I want to somehow transfer that over to you. Is there any mechanism to do that? So says the Gemara discusses a concept of Maimid Shloshtan. It's a Gemara in Gittin. Maimid Shloshtan is another invention of the rabbis that if the three of us are in the room, imagine if you owe me $100. So I want to transfer this debt to someone else. So I say to you, the $100 that you owe me, in the presence of a third party, I want you to now owe it to him. So if all three people are in the same room together, the rabbis invented a kinyan, and this is because of a takana sashok, because this it makes it easier to do business. If you owe me money, and you would like to transfer that debt, to someone else, I can say to you in the presence of the third person, you now owe it to him, and now you will now be obligated. There's a question in Taisus if you have to agree to this, or this can work even against your will, but there's certainly a mechanism that I can transfer the debt that you owe me to somebody else with my mitzvah. So if I have a shtar, I don't have to have all three people in the room at the same time. I can simply hand the shtar over to the other party, or I can hand the shtar over and write another shtar, and that would transfer the debt over to that party rabbinically. If there's no shtar, there's nothing tangible to give over, then I have to have everybody in the same room. And I have to say, I would like the money that you owe me, I would like you to now owe it to the other person. That's my mishloshim. Okay, now if we look in item Yud Beis, let's go back to our check. So now, could we consider, could we consider the check to actually be money? So we just explained from the Chassam Sofer, as valuable as the check is, $1 million check, a person gives you a blank check. The check is $1 million check. It's through the roof. It's worth tons. But it's not gufei mamon, because the Chassam Sofer already explains that at the very least, it's not going to be better than a shtar. It's not gufei mamon. It's not legal tender. There's no requirement on behalf of a vendor to accept this in lieu of money. He won't get in trouble. It's not illegal to refuse the check. You have that all the time, right? The store puts up a sign that we used to accept checks. You know, that's what you see all the time. We used to accept checks, but we've been getting too many cases of bounced checks. We no longer accept checks. We only accept either credit cards or cash. We no longer accept checks. It happens all the time. Everybody used to accept checks. Nowadays, they don't accept checks. They're under no obligation to accept a check. A check is not legal tender. So that right away says that the check is, at the very least, it's only, at the very least, it can only be a shtar, but it cannot be considered to be mamon. That takes that off. Now, there's a concept which I actually would like to talk about one day. Situmta. So we touched on it last time. Situmta is a customary kinyan. A customary kinyan, if something becomes the custom to use as a kinyan, that could sometimes have the validity of a kinyan. So if the custom would be that people accept the check to create to affect the transaction, then that would possibly be a customary kinyan. We talked about this last week when we talked about custom selling futures. If the custom becomes that you could sell something that's not yet in the world, whether or not such a transaction is binding, we discussed that last week. I hope in the future to focus more directly on this concept of situmta. A customary kinyan is binding. It's based on Gemara and Bamitzia. But the Poskim say it's very hard to determine if the custom is actually to consider the check a kinyan. Because after all, everybody knows that the person might be willing to accept the check, but is that the kinyan we discussed in the beginning of tonight's class? Is that the kinyan, or is that just paying for it? It's very unclear. It would be very hard to determine if people are actually accepting the check as a form of a kinyan, or they're only accepting it even when they do accept it. Perhaps they're only accepting it as payment, but they're not necessarily accepting it as a kinyan. So that the classic example someone just mentioned is a handshake. A handshake, tekiyas kaf. Tekiyas kaf is a situmta because that symbolized that we're finalizing the deal. No backsies, you can't back out. But when I give a check, the question is, was that meant to be the method of acquisition, or was that just meant to be a payment? It's very hard to determine. But if theoretically, if we would be able to determine if it becomes customary to consider a check a kinyan, then there will be what to talk about. So far, the check is not considered money because it doesn't have intrinsic value. The check cannot affect the kinyan because it's not clear that a situmta, it's not clear that it qualifies as a customary kinyan because people, it's not a custom. People do not accept the check to perform the actual acquisition. So the question is, maybe it's a shtar chayv. So imagine if somebody gives me a check for $1 million. Would I be able to go over to a girl and marry the girl or purchase a piece of land by giving her that check? Because the Gemara talks about transferring a debt through a shtar. So what if I give it over to you? What if I write a second document on that check? Would that have the status of transferring a debt? So if you think about it, and this is something that the Poskim can talk about, a check is really worse than a debt because the check, a shtar, is the right to collect. It's a right, meaning, what is a shtar? A shtar reflects, a promissory note reflects that you owe me money. Now, either you owe me money because I lent you money before and you gave me a document to prove that you owe me money, or sometimes giving me the document itself will create the obligation. But regardless of why you owe me the money, when you give me a deed, when you give me a promissory note, you now owe me money. And this shtar is like the key. It's like the schus. It's the string that I can use to pull the money out of your pocket. A check does not reflect in any way that you owe me the money. Maybe you do owe me money. Maybe you don't. Maybe when you want to give somebody a bar mitzvah present, you send them a check. You don't owe them money. You're just giving them the right to take money out of your account, right? So when I give you a check, it might be that I owe you the money and I'm using the check to pay you back what I owe you, or it might just be that I'm gifting you the check and I'm giving you the rights to collect the money from my bank account. But in no way am I being mechayev myself by giving you this check. It's just the ability to go and get the money from my account.
But what if when you give the person the check, you put his name on it, and then in the line below, you're putting down the invoice number that you owe?
That's a good question.
What if you put down the promissory note?
That's a beautiful question. That's a beautiful question. So the post can actually say, you can turn a check into a shtar chayv. If you would write on the check that I'm hereby obligating myself to you, that I now, not only am I giving you a check for $100, but I'm obligating myself, I'm creating a debt for $100, that would be a shtar chayv. But a normal check doesn't do that. You're not obligating yourself. Either you're giving him the check because you happen to owe him money from before, or you're giving a bar mitzvah present, you're giving a check for $100, or a wedding present because you're giving a check. But in no way does the check indicate that you owe any money. Right? So for example, we talked about it before. Imagine if I give you a shtar that I have against somebody else and I'm moichel the loive. So we talked about damages. I might have to pay damages. So what if I give you a check for $100 and then I cancel the check? So there's a question if it's legal to do that, if it's ethical to do that. What if I cancel the check? Is it considered that I damaged you? Maybe not, because the check itself does not represent that I owe you the money. It's as if I gave you permission to go take money out of my... Imagine if I have a vault at home and I have a pile of cash in my vault and I gave you permission, I gave you the combination that you can open the vault and take $100 out of the vault. And now I go home and I change the combination. So now you don't have access to the cash. Does that mean that I damaged you? No. Before I gave you permission to take money and now I retracted the permission to take the money. I didn't damage you. There was no kinyan. So the poskim say that a check is actually worse than shtar es chayvus. There's a fact. I saw a shayla brought down. There was once a philanthropist. There was once a moysid. There was an institution. They wanted to build a building. So a big philanthropist, he gave them a check for $10,000. Now, the moysid wanted more from this philanthropist. They didn't want they didn't want to settle on $10,000. Maybe they wanted $100,000. So they said to the philanthropist, they said to him, listen, let me give you back the check. And let's build the building, and we'll see later what you want to give, what the value of the building was. So the gabbai, the executive director, he took the check, but then he returned the check back to the philanthropist. Lo and behold, the philanthropist passed away, and the heirs, the family, they don't want to honor any commitment here. They say, well, you know, we have other interests. Our interests lie with other institutions, whatever it is. And we want to give money to a different institution. We don't want to give stuff to this institution. So now the executive director, he really regrets the fact that he returned the $10,000 check. So he says, wait a minute, your father gave me a $10,000 check. I only returned it in the goodness of my heart, but you already owe me for sure $10,000. So that's a big question. So the is giving a check an eschayvus? This is where it comes into play. The check in no way indicates an obligation. The check is simply permission to take the money from my bank account. It's as if I have cash in a vault at home and I gave you the combination. I gave you permission to take money out. But now that you gave back the check or you lost the check or unless barring a neder, unless the person would consider it a neder, but the orphans are not obligated to honor their father's neder anyway. We talked about that last week. So the organization did not acquire this money. If it would have been a shtar chayv, if it would have been an eschayvus, so then by accepting the shtar, he now owes you the money. But this is just permission to withdraw the money from his account. If you returned it, or if for one reason or another that permission was retracted, there's no act of them. Now, if he really owes you the money, that's one thing. But if it was merely a gift of a check, it's very unclear. It's very hard to prove that a debt or an obligation was created through the writing of a check. The Rashba says such a thing. The Rama in Chayshe Mishpat Samach Vav Sif Dalet brings a Ksuvas Rashba who says that very item. He's talking about where the king was giving the example we had before, that a king gave you permission to go into his vault and take something for a prize, for a reward. So we discussed the concept of transferring the check to somebody else, transferring the shtar to somebody else. So the Rashba says that this is non-transferable because this is not a debt. It's just permission to go into his safe. Now, the king's word is as good as gold, so there's no question that the smichas das, but it's not a debt, it's not a chayv. The permission slip does not represent a debt, so there's no way to transfer this permission over to somebody else. It's non-transferable. It would not have the halacha of a shtar. The Rashba clearly says, "Karav be'enai she'ein shtar kazeh nikna filu b'ksiva u'mesira." The Rashba says that he's pretty sure that there's no way to transfer this over to somebody else because it's not a choif, it's not an obligation. It's merely permission to collect something from the king, and a check today would be like that as well. Now, based on this, in item test Zion. So today's check is not considered money, it's not considered a shtar, and there's no way to transfer this debt to somebody else. So even though people are using checks as if it's currency, and especially in Eretz Israel, it's very prevalent that you give your check to the makolet, and that person gives the check to his landlord, and the landlord gives it to his electrician, whatever it is, and before you know it, the shtar is 10 steps removed, but you don't really owe the money to that final party because it's not something that you can transfer. The only thing that I saw talked about, which would make sense, is that giving a check is like Maimit Shlashtam. Maimit Shlashtam is that where the middle party has money. In other words, when you deposit money with the bank, essentially you're lending money to the bank. The bank owes you money. And you can collect that money at any time. So it's as if you're going to the bank and in the presence of the third party, you're saying, the money you owe me, I might have $1,000 in the bank. Part of that money, the $100 that you owe me, I want you to owe it to somebody else. So perhaps you can transfer the money that's owed to you by the bank to somebody else with my mikshlashton. So the obvious objection to this would be that you have to have all three people in the same room at the same time. So perhaps you can go to the bank manager and you can schlep the recipient in to the bank manager. Maybe you can get an audience with the bank manager in his fancy office and you can all be standing in the office there and you can say, I want to transfer my money over to the third party. Perhaps that would work by Mishloshna. But giving a check over is biksav. So maybe that's considered my Mishloshna, maybe not. I saw people discuss that, but it sounds a little bit far-fetched that would be my Mishloshna because you're not all three in the same room.
My mishlash of the third person there is not the person that you're transferring it to. He's only an eighth.
Well, no. Imagine Toby, you owe me $100. I want to transfer the $100 that you owe me. I want to transfer it to Leo. So I would say, as long as you, Toby, and Leo, me, Toby, and Leo are in the same room. So I could transfer the money that Toby owes me to Leo because all three of us are in the same room. So a check would really be like transfer. Now, the Chut Shani, that's what this in Karelitz, he writes, Bal Tullin. Imagine if this is a fascinating concept. Imagine if you have a babysitter, you want to pay her. We discussed this. You want to pay her the same night. You want to pay her the same day. You don't want to pass the whole day without paying. You want to fulfill the mitzvah of paying your worker on the same day. So I owe the electrician, I owe the painter $500 for painting. So I graciously write the check for $500. The problem is you didn't pay. You gave them permission to take money from your account, but you didn't actually give them the money. So the Chut Shani says you did not fulfill the obligation of paying the worker on time because you did not give him cash. Even what you gave him is not even a promissory note. You didn't even obligate yourself. You owe him money from before, but you essentially didn't do anything more than before. I owe you money. I gave you a check that enables you to go to the bank and get the money, but I didn't give you the money. So I didn't fulfill the obligation of paying the worker on time. Interestingly enough, I'm not in violation either. This is a limbo state. Why? Because I did not pay you, but on the other hand, I gave you the ability to get the money on your own. So therefore, I'm neither here nor there. I did not fulfill the obligation, but at the same time, I'm not in any violation either, because I gave you the ability to get the money. So you didn't get a mitzvah, but at the same time, you didn't get an avera. So it was just a lost opportunity. It's just neither here nor there.
Yeah, gives you a receipt, Mark paid.
Okay.
That's not right then and there.
Okay. Maybe he's being Michael. Essentially, what he's doing is he's accepting that in lieu of payment. He's saying, okay, essentially what he's saying is you did enough. I have the ability to get the money myself, so I'm waiving any further obligation. But he wasn't paid yet. So imagine if I hire a worker and he's Michael. So I didn't get the mitzvah, but I didn't get an Avera. It's neither here nor there. Now, Rav Moshe Feinstein, it's very interesting. He talks about Shemitah. Shemitah is coming up next year. He talks about Shemitah. We all know that at the end of the seventh year, it cancels the loans. He discusses their writing a prosbul. We actually discussed prosbul 2 weeks ago when we talked about Hefker, Bez, and Hefker. It's amazing how many topics we're covering over the time. So Rav Moshe Feinstein actually says there that, believe it or not, a prosbul nowadays is a minhag. Because in the early times, the Ge'onim, nobody was particular to write a prosbul. He says that maybe the Takana only applied in Eretz Yisrael or the areas that were samach to Eretz Yisrael. So the Ravid says it's a midas chasidus to write a prosbul. This is a minhag. It became more customary, became more popular. A lot of mitzvahs became more popular. Checking for shatnes, chadash, yashan. A lot of mitzvahs became more popular. It became more popular to write a prosbul. But the story was they forgot to write a prosbul. Rav Moshe Feinstein says there that technically you can collect the loan even though you neglected to write a prosbul. Rav Moshe has a tshuva in Choshen Mishpat Chelik Beis, Simen Chavav. In passing, now this is not the thrust of his tshuva. In passing, Rav Moshe Feinstein mentions that if the loyve gave you a check to reimburse you for the debt, the loan is not canceled by Shemitah. Now it's basically like a hit and run. Rav Moshe Feinstein does not elaborate. That wasn't the topic. It wasn't the subject of his tshuva. The subject of his tshuva was if you have to write a prosbul altogether. But in passing, he mentions that if I gave you a check, it's as if I gave the loan, and the loan is not canceled. Based on how we're explaining it now, with the chut hashani or the other paiskim, we're looking at the check as if you were not paid. You really owe the money. All the check is a key. It's the combination to the safe that you can go and collect the money, but the money has not yet reached your hands. It's very likely that it's not considered as if I paid. Rav Moshe, without elaborating, says that when I write the check, the loan will certainly not be canceled by Shemitah because it's as if it was paid. So either Rav Moshe has a different understanding and he looks at the check as if you received the cash, or perhaps, because Rav Moshe doesn't elaborate, perhaps Rav Moshe means that since I gave you the ability to collect the cash, I'm no longer subject to Shemitah. Because the pasuk says lo yigosh, you can't approach. And if you no longer have to approach, because you gave him the check, he no longer has to approach you. It's a similar idea to prosbul. You can just get the money on your own. Maybe it's like you have a collateral of sorts. Maybe that's what Rav Moshe means, why it wasn't canceled. Rav Moshe doesn't explain. He just says, in passing, if you wrote a check, it's certainly not canceled. So I'm not sure. Is he arguing on the chut shani? Does he consider giving a check as if you were paid in full? Or is he saying a Shemitah vart? Perhaps he's saying something that's local to Shemitah, that it won't be canceled because you facilitated, you enabled him to get the money. So I'm not sure. But this is the concept today of our currency and our checks. Yasha Koyach, everybody.
This conference is